This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. While I was at the Texas Association of Magicians Convention in Austin, Texas recently over the Labor Day weekend, one of the performers there was Peter Samuelson. Peter is also one of the producers for Monday Night Magic in New York City, which is a long-running show that's been going on there for a very long time, I think 17, 18 years or so. Anyhow, Peter is one of my favorite performers and puts a lot of thought and effort into everything that he does. He spends a lot of time scripting and choreographing all of his material, and as a result, he ends up with a very professional piece, which is why he works some of the top places. He works cruise ships and a lot of great corporate events and travels around the globe all the time doing these wonderful shows. And also, when you get a chance to listen to his lecture, he has some wonderful tips also that he can give you that will apply not only to close-up and stage, but parlor and everything then else as well. Wonderful performer, a good thinker, and during this chat we have together, he shares much of that insight, and so I think you will enjoy Peter Samuelson here on The Magic Word. This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have as my guest someone here at the TAOM, and I thought that I would spend a little bit longer chatting with him because he's one of my favorite magicians, and by the time that you end this, listening to this podcast, you probably will agree why that he is one of my favorite magicians, and soon will be yours, Mr. Peter Samuelson. Hello, Peter.
Hey, hi there.
It really is. I think you are just an outstanding performer because of the passion that you put into your performances. I mean, this is not something in which that looks like it's off the cuff. Everything that you do, it seems like it's scripted and not just the wording of it. And that is that it seems like when you're performing that it's well choreographed, it's well thought out with each gesture and everything. And Bob Fitch was here at this convention. I know that he's a friend of yours. Have you spent some time working with Bob by chance?
You know, I've never studied with Bob. Years and years ago, Bob came in. I was doing some work with my friend and partner at the time, Damien. He and I were working and had a company called The Magic Source together. And we brought Bob in to work with us on some work that we were doing. We had a piece particularly that we were working on, and we found it really beneficial. It was great. I've never been to one of Bob's workshops, but I've been a longtime fan and friend of Bob's, and I've always benefited from his knowledge and his wisdom. Mm-hmm. And there have been times of just spending opportunities with him, moments where we just sit and talk or things, or he recounts and relates his stories, which he loves to do, and each one of them is just sort of filled with these little gems of wisdom, sort of take those away. It was like, for me, in some ways, it was like studying Slidini. I never studied with Slidini, but I studied Slidini. So just as John Carney was talking about in his lecture today, that you can try to imitate Tony Slidini and get the gestures down, mm-hmm. and the timing, and it was him. That was really very unique for Slidini's work. And so the value is to really listen and to think about what it is that you're hearing from them or what it is you're learning from them, and then realize how you have to change what you're doing to incorporate what they're saying. Mm-hmm. So that's for me with Bob as well. I can't be Bob Fitch, but yeah. Bob has all these ways of looking at things and ways of physicalizing character that are just mind-boggling. At his lecture the other day, there was this moment where he talked about there are different ways in which, for example, somebody might find a lost $50 bill that's lying on
the different ground. Ways that exactly. the person would do
and
that.
And he did four different characters in the mm-hmm. space of about 2 minutes, and it was incredible because each one of them was not defined with broad gestures or broad characterizations, but it's all the little details that he sort of weaves into these things. The guy's eye movements, his breathing, his posture that happens in there, his attitude towards the people that are around him, the way his eyes are looking. Are they focused on the bill? Are they looking at the people around him to see who's looking at him? Does he have to hide his action, or is he just very open about it? Is he trying to find the owner, or is he just wanting to keep it for himself? So Bob is really this, he's this great sort of this resource of ways of looking at yourself. And that was the thing I enjoyed about John Carney's lecture that we just finished listening to as well. The attention to the detail. Tearing things apart, not for the sake of tearing them apart, but to make them better. His distinction between things that are easier and things that are simple. The simple method is not always the easiest method. As a matter of fact, simple is something that you strive for and you spend years working on to make something elegant and simple and with no wasted motions, that there's nothing extraneous.
You're cutting away, you're not adding to
it. Yes, exactly. It's that old idea of a sculpture.
Exactly.
You chip away the marble that's in the way of the actual
David
form.
Is in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, one thing, too, I think, is that is having the conviction. In other words, that, like going back to Bob, when you're on stage, a lot of times I see some magicians who are performing, and I get the feeling that they're thinking about their next move, where they're going to be standing next, what their next trick's going to be, or where their hand is going because I'm going to need to pick up something else. And you can almost sense that. So they're thinking too much about that, and perhaps it's because of lack of rehearsal, which is different from scripting. We'll get to it later. Yeah. But the thing is, I'm saying that they don't have the conviction and the belief of that because they are not emoting that. That is, that their look, their expression, their eyesight, like you were just saying, where they kind of raise their eyebrows or whatever, that sometimes people, they may be thinking, well, I'm in a theater or whatever. People can't see it in the back, but they can.
Yes.
You know, you can see that, particularly if you have the right makeup and everything.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's really, I think, the essence of what you're talking about, which is that you need to find the motivation. Where does the things come from? I don't mean to really to say, oh, I have to be motivated. But this idea of, I mean, both Bob and John was talking about this also, this idea of being passionate about this. Mm-hmm. So not to just simply say, okay, that's good enough, but sort of keep working on it, keep playing with it over years and years. And things do take years to develop, as you well know, that it's not the sort of thing that just comes to you in an instant. Now, there are routines in which that happens, and then you spend a long time just refining them. But just as you mentioned, this idea of editing, of, for example, with a script, to be able to sort of pull away the extraneous words. Bob, in his workshop the other day, said, if you're on stage and you say, okay, now what we're going to do is, it's like,
I hate that.
Eliminate
it,
those phrases.
Sure.
It's not what we're going about to do. Just do it.
It does not drive the thing forward, you know.
Exactly.
Years ago when I was working at the Magic Island, when it was open, Scott Hollingsworth was always a great director. And I was a UPC gag that I was using, and I was literally milking it. I was getting, I think, probably about 6 laughs per minute, and I was making it into a 5-minute routine or something. Scott said, you know what you need to do? Some of these things are not working, some of the gags and whatnot. And he'd let me kind of run 2 or 3 nights and so many shows. He said, why don't you try cutting and doing a few things less rather than more? And that's exactly what I did. I cut it down to like a 2-minute routine, and I was getting like 17 laughs per minute, still getting a lot more out of it and cutting things.
Yeah.
And just it's a matter of kind of whittling it away and then getting to the essence of what that effect actually would be.
Exactly right.
When you had developed, let's say, like the smoke in the glass and the coins that are developing like that, was that, were you a smoker in which that you started using smoke? I mean, with a cigar one day and say, hey, I, you know, kind of blow some smoke? Or
Actually not. I started working on that routine shortly after I'd stopped smoking.
Okay.
I never smoked cigars, but I'd smoked cigarettes for a small amount of time, not for only a couple of years when I was young, and I just realized that I'd gotten sick, and I realized that the amount of money I was spending on cigarettes, and this is when they were still cheap, not like they are today, and I went, this is ridiculous. I could actually be having a meal out every week and living in New York, and money was not – there was not a lot of it, so it was struggling. So it was an interesting thing to do, to try and do that. And I'd been fascinated by the piece, the Pachelbel piece, for many, many years.
Yeah.
I'd always loved that piece of music. It was before it became the GE light, you know, and everybody had been using it at their weddings and everything else.
Right.
So, but it had been a piece that had fascinated me, and it came out of the sense of the vision that what I heard when I listened to that music was I had an image that started forming in my mind of being on a raft in an ocean surrounded by fog, and this gentle swelling, this motion of this raft as it goes through this fog bank where you can't really see, but this beautiful sense of motion without real definition, and out of those things would appear out of that fog. And that's where that came from, this inspiration for that piece, is listening to the music and going, oh, this feels like smoke or fog. I love the way the thing moves. And then I remembered the bar gag of the filling a glass with smoke and being able to pour it. Later on, I saw Tom Mulica do it years later when I was down at the Tomfoolery, and he used to do a cocktail, smoke cocktail piece that he did. But
that was
after this that I developed this, and I realized that that's what I really absolutely loved was the way the sense of the smoke moving and pouring and flowing and then things coming out of it. So that's where that came from, in this idea because you never know where an idea is going to come from.
That's exactly right.
You know, is it a piece of magic that you love to see? For example, Gypsy Thread for me was something that I always loved, and I didn't know why I loved it, and I had to figure out some reason for myself that would work, that made it all right for me to do this piece, that I felt that people would get something out of it, that there would be something that it was about that mattered to me. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's the piece itself contains the presentation within it, the Gypsy Thread of something breaking apart and then being put back together, or you wish you could put it back together. The smoke came out of the imagery for that, so music and the imagery of that. So you never know where these inspirations come from, and then once you have these ideas, you sort of take them and you move forward with them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it happens quickly. The Phoenix came about very quickly. It was Irv Weiner had been doing a lecture, and I loved Irv's work.
Yeah, Mr. Fingers.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Here's a man who, you know, late in his career was out working colleges and getting 3 standing ovations in the course of his show. In the middle of the show, I mean, people were standing up and applauding. He found a way through his personalization of things. He found a real way to connect with people. And I remember watching him do the Torn and Restored and then Burnt Napkin. And I went, that's really wonderful. But again, what is it about for me? And I was up in Boston visiting friends of mine who were directing me in some pieces that I was working on. And then we were out at a bar one night, and I was a girl I was flirting with. And all of a sudden I thought, oh, let me do this piece. And the idea of the Phoenix just happened. And then I came back to New York, and I brought it back, and my good friend Jamie Swiss and I were sort of sitting. I said, look, I've just come up with this presentation of stuff, and he and I worked on scripting. He took it away down to Washington, where he was doing some work with Bob Sheets. Mm-hmm. And he came back.
Was that back in the Brook Farm Inn days?
It was after the Brook Farm. Okay. It was the Wheaton Inn of Magic that is down there. And so Jamie came, took it away and reworked some of the scripting on it, and then I took it and sort of did more stuff with it. And so it really grew out of that. But that all began in an instant. There are other things that sort of take time to develop, and just it's this idea.
It's kind of funny, isn't it, how some things almost pop to mind. It's like they're complete.
Yeah.
In and of it, you can't add much to it. And others, oh, you just grind away at that for years. You know, it's an unfinished symphony, you know.
I've always loved The 7 Keys of Baldpate.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Great little piece. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of thought, well, what does it work for me? Why is it interesting to me? What is it? You're trying to find the key to the lock, trying to find the solution to the thing. What I mean, it's sort of built in, again, mm-hmm. into the effect. And I was out working cruise ships, and I remember bringing up couples, and I thought, well, I'm going to try and do this. So I had a chain, and I would chain the lady to the mic stand, and he had to fend off suitors by finding the right key, because they're all flirting with the lady. Yeah. I thought, well, that's kind of fun. That's really nice to do. And then I did a show in New York called Paperwork. And in the show, I would come out and I'd say, you know, there are many things that are dangerous for magicians to do, but one of the greatest dangers that we face are critics. Bad reviews can kill a show, and I brought along a stack of my bad reviews, and I had a huge bundle of newspaper, and I said, this is what always hangs over your head. It's like a sword of Damocles. So tonight, I will literally have this hanging over my head, and the only thing that protects me is this lock, and 4 of you will play critics, or 5 of you will play critics from the, from the audience, and I have to find the one who will write the good review, so I can avoid the danger and the damage or whatever it was.
Right.
So, and that's what that was. And I sort of been playing this back and forth, and I'd been kicking around different ways of doing things. And a couple of years, I think 2006 or so, my partner Karen and I were lying in bed, and we're both on our computers and IMing each other, I think it was.
Did you get my IM?
And she looked over and she said, hey, take a look at this. And it was, she knew I'd been thinking about this for a long time. And it was a picture of the love locks, the bridges that are covered locks. Mm-hmm. It was the first article that I'd ever seen of it. It was in the New York Times many, many years ago, before it had spread around the world.
Okay.
It was really a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And it started in Italy before it had moved to Paris and Japan and other places.
We have one in Houston even right now.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And now my friend Joe Devlin travels. I've got all my friends. He sent me some from I was getting them from all over the world. Ray Crow was sending me things from Eastern Europe when he was performing there. And so it was, I get these wonderful pictures. But she leaned over and she said, look at this. And it was this picture of the Ponte Milvio in Rome. And I went, that's really great. That's what, because these are the lovers that come to do this. And I think this is a great image of all these locks and us finding the right key to the person we care about and opening their heart. And then I realized that it's a great image, but you're going to need that key tomorrow and the day after that, because she doesn't open her heart just once to you.
Wow.
She has to open it every day.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, okay. But so what he's going to do is, yeah, he's thrown away the key. He needs to find it again.
He needs to find the key to open her heart again.
And okay. Once she's done that. So I find a couple and I bring them up. So I now do a piece called The Love Locks. And it's a beautiful piece that I've done. And I finally figured out a way to end up with it. And it merges a ring and box. There's a little heart-shaped box that her wedding ring goes into. And that gets locked away. And he's now got to win her heart again to get her to open her heart. And instead of using 5 keys, we have like 13 or 15, just a bunch of keys, mm-hmm. because I don't want it to just seem easy. He has to really
not
work
just one out of seven or whatever. Yeah,
mm-hmm. And the only other thing that comes into play on this, and it's actually an interesting thought when you approach different kinds of magic, is there's kind of a predictability that you need to avoid. It's one of the problems that I always have with straitjackets is the person's going to get out, which is people like Andrew Goldenhurst has got great solution to this, where he does this amazing. He says, "I'm going to do this with," and he puts eggs into the sleeve. So the idea is to be able to escape without breaking the eggs. And there's a kicker ending to this, which is just mind-boggling, that I won't tell you about because you need to see Andrew do this. But for me, that was one of the problems, is that you sort of see the predictability of him going through all the keys, and none of them work except for the one, and he goes through and he's down to the one key, and of course it's going to open the lock.
Yeah.
But it doesn't in this routine.
Oh. Interesting.
No.
That's, yeah.
It doesn't.
So otherwise it'd be anticlimactic. Well, of course it's supposed to open, but
right,
if it doesn't.
Exactly. And that's one of those moments where the audience is sitting there going, oh yeah, okay, so it's going to open the lock. And so he goes up and he tries it, and it doesn't work. I go, of course it doesn't work. You don't really care about this. You're taking this like it's a joke, like I'm going to do all the work for you. You have to be passionate about this. We're talking about the woman you're going to spend 47 years of your life with. What are you doing? Back in your corner. So he goes back to where he is, and I explain to him that, the women understand this much better than men do. I'll show you what I'm talking about. And so I have her take out 2 keys, and then she gives him one. I say, there it is. She has made a selection, handed you the key. And he walks over, takes the key, puts it into the lock, and it doesn't work. You know why? Because they never give you that key. They say, oh, yeah, honey, here's the key to my heart. They don't mean it. It's their key and their key alone. They're never giving it up. I'm not bitter. And she takes the key and she opens the lock, and it opens her heart. I said, of course, the woman has to open her heart for you.
Mm-hmm. And only you can't open her heart. She opens it for you.
Exactly.
Wow.
Right.
So that all comes. Brilliant. That's brilliant. But one of the things I think also is it's an emotional hook that the audience can relate to, and that brings everybody through. Talk about breaking the fourth wall. They're standing on the stage with you emotionally
with
that routine.
Yeah. And it's really great because then at the end the ring is gone and it ends up inside of a little box that's been sitting over there for the whole time. And then he has to put the ring back on her finger. And I was doing this routine at the World Magic Seminar. This was a couple of years ago. Lupe had invited me to come down. It was when I was in Pix. And I'm doing the show and I say, okay, now you can put the ring back on her finger the way you did 26 years ago and you may now kiss the bride. And the woman goes, oh no, he's going down on his knee.
That's good.
And I said, what do you mean? I asked her later. She said, when we got married, he never went down on his knee, and we're back here renewing our vows. He's going down on his knees.
Yeah.
I thought, that's brilliant. So to this day, ever since that day, he goes to put back the ring, and I go, oh, no, wait, down on your knee.
The proper way.
So he goes down on his knee, and he puts the ring back on, and I always snap a picture for them just at that moment. I take a picture of my iPhone out of my pocket, and I grab a picture, and I email it to them. So,
wow, that's great.
So
a good marketing tip there, too, because you get their email.
Exactly right.
Then, too. Brilliant. Now, that's a stage routine, and then you have done a stage and as well as close-up.
Yes.
And most of these have music accompaniment.
Yeah.
You mentioned how the canon had influenced you.
Right.
Are you listening to music all the time in the radio, or like as you're jogging or working out, or have you got...
Not really, no. I mean, I guess I hear all the music a lot because there's a lot of music that goes in, and I use music a lot. It's almost like I want a soundtrack for my entire show.
For my life, really, exactly.
I want better lighting and a soundtrack.
You've been in New York on Broadway too long, man.
Well, that's so true. Boy. So, you know, it's interesting. I do listen to music, and I think that a lot of it comes from popular culture. The stuff is in there, and mm-hmm. things sort of go, you know, sort of filter through me. I listen to a lot of audio books, actually, when I'm traveling. And doing
I love that, too. Yeah. When we make some long road trips for like 8 or 9 hours, that I could put in something and listen then as well. Yeah. Do you, when you're out on ships, do you listen to audio books then?
I do, actually. Mm-hmm. I listen to that, and I listen to magic lectures, and I listen to a bunch of stuff.
And this podcast and this kind of thing.
Of course. Absolutely. You bet. Absolutely.
Well, what kind of genre of books do you enjoy?
I actually really like mysteries and science fiction. Those are the two mm-hmm. strengths.
I love Stephen King. Are you into that?
I've never been into King, but, you know, there's a lot of Regina Reynolds is also a big fan of audiobooks, and she and I talk mystery writers and goes all the way back. I think the thing that for me about mysteries that I kind of like is this idea of things that seem to have no explanation throughout this story sort of come into play. So you sort of, you get to the point where you actually can, you find a solution that you don't see. It's not obvious. In some ways, that ties into the magic for me as well. The magic is all about this mystery that we as magicians try to make sure we're making sense of in the world. And I think that's one of the things that's fascinating both about books like that and about the magic. There's this desire to find things that are mysterious in this world and find a way for them to make sense. Mm-hmm. To sort of solve these problems. And with the magic, we don't necessarily explain to people, but we give them a way to sort of incorporate these mysteries into mm-hmm. their life in a way that's okay, that's not challenges, it doesn't threaten them. It actually gives them more to understand about the world,
right.
not less.
I think it's important that magicians, people in general, I think, will read things outside of what their world of influence is, so this way that they become more well-rounded, certainly. And you might draw an influence or an idea for this for your personality to put into your show and everything. One thing I think is interesting, I had this discussion with Terry Seabrook years ago, and that is how many magicians not only love mysteries but Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. It seems like that there is a natural thing because the way that Holmes would think through things, and it's not just mysteries, but it was kind of how he would draw inferences from certain things, the way people would dress or stand or what they're wearing, whatever kind of a thing, you know, their personalities. And magicians a lot of times have to do that, particularly when you're selecting an audience volunteer, which brings me then to you selecting volunteers.
Yes.
Well, that's one of the most difficult things, and I have I can't say that I've ever had a bad volunteer choice. Even those who have been drunk and people are saying, you shouldn't have gotten that person, I have it turned around and say, man, that was great, and you really handled him or her properly, you know, and respectfully or whatever. And it was funnier. It always works out because I kind of play with whatever it is. You have to have, I think, the right personality to be able to do that. My question is, how do you go about trying to select a volunteer? Do you kind of qualify them by telling a few jokes? I mean, I've talked to some guys, and they'll say, yeah, that's what I do. As I'm warming up, I see who's reacting to this or that, and then I bring them up. No, yes or no?
I don't do that.
You just throw out a ball and whoever catches
so.
It.
It depends on what the crowd's like. If it's a magic convention like this, one of the things that's really difficult is it tends to be usually an older crowd, or it tends to be a situation where you really try to see if you can find somebody who is not a magician to participate for me on a lot of the things. I think specifically about the Lady Fair routine, the mutilated parasol routine that I do. Mm-hmm. I've done it with a wide range of people. I've done it with younger people, kids even as well. It's a love story. And so at a certain age, if the kids are really young, they get really embarrassed when they start realizing it's a love story. And so that's really funny, and it plays its own way. Teenagers can be a little bit difficult if they kind of are a little bit rebellious. There's a time when so I tend to avoid that. So young adults are really great for me, mm-hmm. sort of late teens, early 20s, right in that range. So if I can find somebody in that range, that's great. If I can't, then I'll work with really anybody.
Very emotive, you think, or what?
I look for somebody who's isn't it a tough thing to try to display? It's kind of an intuitive sense you develop after doing this long enough to look at somebody and go, I think they're going to be good. Mm-hmm. I like this. There's a sort of you check them out and you sort of see them as you're wandering through. They're not hiding. They're not jumping up to try and be part of the show with you. They seem to have a pleasant look to their face. Mm-hmm. They're on their face is sort of either not necessarily a smile, but that you get a sense about the attitude and what happens with that, you know. And then I have to find, for me, it's tough because I have to pick not only for that routine specifically, I have to pick not only the woman, she's really important, she's yes. critical for this. Mm-hmm. The guy has to work with her mm-hmm. in the sense of they have to be the balanced ages.
That's
so I can't have a young woman
yeah.
and a really older guy.
Or
that doesn't
versa.
Work.
Yeah.
It's okay to have a slightly older woman and a younger guy. For some reason, that seems to be fine.
Yeah.
But it really you really want to find somebody that's kind of, you know, in that early range.
But trying to find the right volunteer, I know, is difficult. I was working on yeah. a cruise ship once on Crystal Sea, and that Silver Seas, and I was asking someone beforehand, a few people, and to the person they said, no, I don't want to be up, I don't want to help or whatever. So I ended up finding people during the course of the show.
Right.
And so that's when I learned, particularly on cruises, that in certain cruises, at least, that you will have a certain clientele in which they really would prefer just to come and be entertained and not mm-hmm. be part of the entertainment. But if they're dragged on stage, then they may not mind because it's a surprise, but they don't want to have to be prepared because then they're worried about trying to come up all the time, you know. Now, doing some pre-show is completely different, if
yes.
you know, but asking someone beforehand to be a volunteer, I think, is a difficult thing.
Yeah. I think you can get away in some ways with people standing in the audience. If you can get them standing in the audience and work with them in that capacity, they're much more willing to do that, and mm-hmm. you sort of are safer in that way than finding somebody to come up on the stage. So in some ways, if you can get somebody to stand in the audience first
yes.
Before you bring people up, that's actually an interesting way to do it, because yeah. then people see, oh, you're okay, you treat them well, it's fine. Because people are never sure. There's sort of this long, you know, mm-hmm. are you going to make fun of me? What's this going to be like? So it's really important, as you know, to treat them respectfully.
And that's what I like also whenever I have the opportunity when I'm performing for a corporate group. I try to encourage them to hire me to do some walk around strolling beforehand, because you are much more likely in that intimate atmosphere one on one to engage in a relationship, if you will. So later when you are calling him up on stage, it's like, oh, I know he's a regular guy. He's not going to embarrass me because I've already spoken to him for five
right.
or 10 minutes and I know his style and his personality.
Right.
As opposed to if you're just doing your show, they're still trying to judge you. They make a first impression, certainly. And right or wrong, they have that impression, and that if you come off to begin with as being kind of a smart aleck, then they're going to be less likely to rush to the stage when you ask them to help.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point. You know, there are some performers who say, oh, no, I don't want them to even see me before I start my show. Mm-hmm. I want to come out fresh. I want to just make that impression. I don't want to have that. I agree with you. I actually feel comfortable. I have no trouble at all doing some walking around and do some mm-hmm. performing with people and just get to know them a little bit before the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of has to be done in the right way, obviously, because mm-hmm. what you really want to do is you want to make sure that you're making friends, but you're also checking people out. It also allows you, if you need to do pre-show work, to be able to do it in a way where people aren't going, oh, well, what are you doing out
right.
here? Oh,
you're
talking to people before the show. Well, yeah, I'm actually performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that works really nicely as well. Yeah.
And going back then to New York, and I mentioned Broadway, that mm-hmm. have you worked much or done things on Broadway dramatically? Did you do something in school in drama? Or?
I did. Ever since I was in junior high school, I've been doing theater work. Mm-hmm. I did junior high school and junior theater in high school. I ended up majoring in theater. I went to school at Stanford. I thought I was going to be a physicist. I was doing all these advanced physics courses mm-hmm. and AP courses in high school, and I ended up going out there, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to become an academic, or I'm going to do research. I'm going to be a physicist. And I got there, and I was doing okay, and I looked around, and I went, there are guys here who are really smart. I'm okay, but these guys are really smart.
Yeah.
And I'm going to end up doing the sort of the lower level jobs. And in a field like that, I don't want to be just putting in my time. Mm-hmm. I either want to do something that's going to be really important, or I want to do something I really care about. And I ended up switching into theater and moving to New York because I thought I would do, you know, important theatrical work, and we'd be doing investigative stuff, or we'd be doing, you know, experimental theater and I was doing improvisational work when I got to New York, and working with a guy named Sheldon Patinkin who was doing improv theater. He went up to help them set up Second City TV up in Toronto. And
that's where Mandy Patinkin's brother or something?
No relation?
Okay.
No. And so that was, you know, an interesting thing. And I realized in New York that most of the actors who made any money above poverty wages mm-hmm. in the union actors, the equity actors, those that made more than, I don't know at the time, I think the figure was like $5,000 annually in the business, anybody that made more than that There was a small percentage that was making more than that. So out of all of the equity actors, there was something like 10% of the people that were making more than $5,000 a year, mm-hmm. which is nothing.
Yeah.
And of that 10%.
A year. Wow. Okay.
And of that 10% that were making that amount of money, 90% of them were making it doing commercials. And I said to myself, I've just gone through all this university training to learn how to do this, to become an actor, to sell product? Nah. No. If I'm going to be selling product, I want it to be my product.
Yeah. Brand
and I was
yourself.
Doing exactly myself, my own ideas, things that I want to say. And mm-hmm. I'd been doing a summer theater festival. We were doing a summer theater company that we were taking up to the Adirondacks. It was my college girlfriend who I moved to New York with and a distant relative, a cousin of mine. And we formed a theater company. We were taking it up to the Adirondacks and we were going to be doing a whole season. The first town that we were scheduled to go in had already seen one of the three plays that we were doing at that mm-hmm. point. And we said, well, what are we going to do? We have to replace it with something because they saw it last year. Nobody's going to come to see this. And so we said, well, we've got 10 people in the company. Let's do a magic show. I said, yeah, let's do a magic show.
And so you didn't have any magical training at that point.
Oh, I had. I've been doing magic ever since I was in junior high school.
Oh, okay.
Oh yeah. Ever since I was 11 years old, I'd been doing stuff. And I started a magic club back in Ann Arbor. And Charles Rolfs was living in Ann Arbor. He was a big collector back in the thing. So and I dated his daughter during high school. And the magic club met at his house. And it was really great. There were not a lot of magicians in there. But I grew up watching, I was watching Milky the Clown,
Carol Fox.
And doing this sort of stuff, and Magic Ranch and
yeah.
all these things. So this was, I had access to seeing things in the early days of television that were happening, coming out there. But there were not a lot of magicians actually in the Ann Arbor area, and that's why it was really important for me to sort of do that. And I got to a point, and this was sort of late 60s. I graduated in 67 from high school, and I went immediately out to California. And this was the period of the war in Vietnam, and I realized I was starting to become very comfortable with an art form that was making the main point fooling people and having them enjoy being fooled.
Mm-hmm.
I said, the government is doing a much better job fooling people than anything I could do. So I said, maybe this is not what I want to do. I want people to know more about the world at the end of a show, not go, oh, hey, I have no idea how we did that, and that's fine with me. I don't need to know anything. No, you need to know things. You need to think about this life. You need to think about something.
Not just what Michael Marr would call bubblegum for the eyes, but
right.
something that's more important, sustenance.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so when I came back to the magic later on, I realized that there was something I wanted to do with it. I wanted to start to make it my theater.
Yeah.
I went into theater because I wanted to do something important, say something important, make people think about something, and I realized that in a theater, sometimes there's only one person in the audience that walks away going, that was an incredible performance, and that's the person you're playing for. Is mm-hmm. you'd love to have an standing ovation from everybody in the audience,
sure.
but if you only touch one person, that's significant, mm-hmm. because sometimes you can do that. And I realized I wanted to do that with the magic.
Yeah.
I wanted to reach out and actually touch people and do that sort of stuff, so I came back to it and came back from that summer theater company. I did a children's theater out of New Orleans called Project Educational Theater. Mm-hmm. We toured to 80,000 kids in 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It was just amazing. And I came back and became one of the people at the Magic Townhouse in New York, Wesley James, a guy named Al Cooper,
sure.
and myself. And it was Dick Brooks and Dorothy Dietrich were running the place, or shortly after I came there, they were running it. And there was an amazing collection of people. David Roth was there. It's when I first met Penn and Teller. They were there. Slidini was coming in. I mean, everybody. Frank Garcia came down.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an amazing
Harry
opportunity.
Lorraine. Yep.
Harry Lorraine,
mm-hmm.
Senor Mardo.
Mm-hmm.
Jack London, whose prediction, he has a sealed prediction that's an absolutely great prediction, a notarized prediction that's just great that I've
yeah.
used for years and years and years. And
well, what about some of those guys that you had met from way back when? I mean, you got any stories or something about something that comes to mind?
Oh, man, I sort of mentioned this in the lecture when I'm sitting there trying to figure out how to approach the chop cup, and there's this, there's this moment in the chop cup where you've got to slam the cup down just to get the ball to release on
right.
that. And I could never figure out how I could cover that move, and I actually turned to Slidini and I said, what would you do? And he demonstrated something that he was doing, and at the point where he had to release the ball, he would pick up the cup expecting the ball to be there and look really frustrated and sort of slam it back down onto the table in frustration and say, okay, let me do this again. And then it would be there. And I realized that you could use that emotional moment
mm-hmm.
to cover all these things. Cardini, for example, you know, I talked a little bit about justification in the lecture, and there are three types. There's logical, physical, and emotional. The emotional justification could become really important. When Cardini, and this is may or may not be an apocryphal story, but I've heard this so many times, I believe it to at least to be real in my mind, if nowhere else. So Cardini, for whom the magic happens to him, is reaching out and he's doing billiard ball productions, and a ball appears in his hands, and he's wearing the monocle, and the surprise sort of overcomes his face, and his eyes open wide and in surprise at the ball being there, and at which point the monocle drops. It's on a little chain, so it drops to just at the right point, just below his waistcoat. He reaches down because he wants to see, so he picks up the monocle, puts it back in his eye, and has stolen the ball from the waistcoat as he's picking up the monocle. So this emotional part of this that allows you to put yourself in situations where the motions you're making are completely natural becomes really important. And so there were moments like that, like sitting with Slidini and doing this, or having Frank Garcia take some of my material and include it in the book, and I'm going, that's really important. Hanging out with Mike Gallo and David Roth and Jeff Latta and Jamie Swiss, these are all, you know, there was this contingent of folks that we just really, you know, there was this great Derek Dingle, you know.
Did you get together like at a round table or a breakfast or lunch?
I never was part of that round table. There were round tables in New York, and there were sort of the magic table and magic cafes and stuff like that. I was never really a part of that.
Okay.
No, I had personal friends. I was a shy kid. I always sort of felt a little bit out. I wasn't a move guy, although I would work on technique, and it was really important to me to do this stuff. The theatrical part of the life sort of dragged me away into all of this stuff. There was a time when we got hired by Revlon. It was myself, Jack Adams, and Michael Albright, who was coming in from California. And we were hired by Revlon to do a show called Color Magic. We toured the country with this show. They split the country into three parts. And so Michael pretty much had the West Coast, and Jack for the most the East Coast, and I did a lot in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Because that's where I was from originally. And we were doing all sorts of wonderful magic. And it was a great time for me to really get to know Jack Adams, who was a great creative mind. He really spent a lot of time doing great theatrical things and costume changes and always was introducing me to new way of thinking about things. And at one point, Revlon came to us and they said, oh, we've got this umbrella. Can you use this as part of the thing? It was called Color Magic. And they built this box for us that was 4 feet high.
And you're doing this, by the way, for salespeople or
we were doing this. We were doing this in department stores, in Macy's
or
primarily,
just walking or by.
A Famous Bar,
okay,
or all
sure,
these
sure.
wonderful stores, you
right.
know. And we were literally traveling around the country with this huge black lacquered box that contained all the props, including a Lucite table and everything we needed for the show, that would then open up and lay down, and then became a platform on which we could stand and perform. So that was really wonderful. And they sort of threw in at the last minute, can you do something with our, we've got this Chaz umbrella, can you do something? And we were going, yeah, sure, we can do something. And Jack and I said, yeah, Magic Hands had just come out with a mutilated parasol idea using a full-sized umbrella. And we thought, well, we can do this, but you can't do that surrounded. So we need to modify this to make it so you can really do it surrounded. And I went back to this college girlfriend and I, and we were, you know, working on shows, and I said, I want to write a routine that's going to be really great for us to do this. And so we did. And this is the routine I'm still using almost word for word this many years later. Took it out of the Revlon world and made it just a story that becomes this
standalone piece. That Mr. Smooth and the
Lady Fair and Mr. Smooth, yeah. I mean, Jay Marshall one point came up to me and he said, that's the best mutilated parasol I've ever seen.
Yeah, because a lot of times they put it back together or something. You know, why should you? You've already done this. There's no sense in it's like changing one to a hundred. Well, then they go back to ones. Well, why? You know, I mean, you've proven something. The magic has happened. Next time it's just going to be a lesson.
Exactly.
And so with this, I think that, yeah, you've told a story, and it had a satisfying ending, so why do you need a coda on that, you know?
And now, and especially the way it is now, it's a 7-minute piece with using spectators that's completely scored to music, and it was a good friend of mine who was a musical director, George Schneider, was out on the cruise ships. I was out working, and they would start improvising stuff, and eventually I got him to score this to me, and we recorded it. It is now completely scripted music. You know, here we've got the soundtrack for the effect, and it's all with changes built into it, and it's all timed, and I have to work to the music because there's no getting around that. It's got to hit on these beats, you know.
Go ahead.
Which I was just going to say can be challenging when you're dealing with live spectators.
Oh, sure.
And you never know what they're going to do.
I think it's interesting that course or that path that you've taken did not include working children's birthday parties to kind of move up to this or working restaurants or whatever. I mean, you started with something in mind and have succeeded in that. And where do you find venues? I mean, we don't have the vaudevilles, we don't have the nightclubs or the types of places that they had of yesteryear or maybe even still in some parts of Europe that they may have. And so aside from cruise ships and the corporate parties and Monday Night Magic and other places, where do you find these opportunities?
Well, occasionally you find these wonderful chances to do things like, Rich Block has got this wonderful place, the Dickens Parlor Theater. And he's expanded down at Ocean City, so he has a second venue down in there. Yeah, it's in a hotel. It doesn't have quite the feel. They've done as good a job as they can on this, but the Dickens is a beautiful little theater. You know, there's a theater outside in New Jersey called the Sparta Theater, which is really great. Joe Given and Carol have got this great little place. Exactly, the Theater of Dreams in Castle Rock out there. There's the Magic Dinner Theater that's up in Martinez and the Bay Area. That's places like that. There are theaters like
this. That's true. There are a few magicians. In fact, I had a podcast a while back on that. There are theaters and magic, and there's Wizards, of course, down that Eric Olson has.
I'll be performing there, as a matter of fact, the Monday after the Genie Convention.
And the Red Spade, I think, in San Diego, and I mean from coast to coast. And I know that some people have put together their own theaters, like Evangelista, in Florida again, and others who have tried to find a place to show themselves or to highlight their own shows and be able to work on that, but also bringing in guests. If I'm thinking of Christian and Catalina, up in Indianapolis, have got a theater that's been working successfully for a number of years. Or you have, of course, the best thing, of course, was Steve Cohen there, who's done very well at the Waldorf Astoria with the chamber magic and everything.
Exactly. Right.
So there are those kinds of places, I guess. But a lot of times that they are highlighting
the person who's created them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's lovely about Joe and Carol is that they do that for their own performances, and they have a large clientele in the area that comes to them for this. But they also open it up for lectures and performances by visiting magicians. There's a place in Mexico that I go and work that's a whole series of resorts that are down there, and that's been challenging because it's there are different kinds of venues. You're working at the resorts, but they're always different. Sometimes it's an outside space, sometimes inside. And the one thing you learn is you can't wear a jacket down there. So
I think I've heard Doc Hilford. Does he work down there too?
Doc was down there, and John Stetson has been down there. Yeah. Bob Sheets has been down there, exactly. And I'm there because Todd Robbins, my buddy, has said, hey, you should bring Peter in to do this sort of work. And so, there are no.
But you can't wear a jacket what? I'm sorry.
It's just too hot and humid. It's just like, and I was using sleeve loads and some other things. It's like you can't do that. Yeah. So I had to change methodology and change my changed the performing persona. So you really have to start to push because it's a different kind of audience. And so I've really tried over the course of the last couple of years. I've moved out of doing sort of larger theatrical shows, although there's sometimes that comes back in and still again. But still trying to find ways to be more mobile and more flexible, sort of shorter setup times, but still be able to have some sort of theatrical impact that can still play with that. So that's been challenging and fun to do.
Well, one of the things also, of course, speaking of theaters, was Monday Night Magic, and you were instrumental in working with that. You want to talk a little bit about the development of that?
Sure. This was like 1997, and I got a call from Michael Chout, and Michael said to me, he said, there's no place in New York anymore now that Mostly Magic is closed up. And I said, I know, that's really not a good thing. Mm-hmm. We're like a major city, aren't we? And he said, yeah. I said, shouldn't there be a home for live magic, someplace that people can come to see live magic? And Michael said, well, that's why I'm calling you. I think we want to start this thing called Monday Night Magic. And John Lenihan had started this in London, had been doing this on a Monday night. And the idea behind Monday Night Magic was that the theaters are dark on Monday. So theaters they're accessible. They're available for rent. And people, you can put in a show without having to have the rent for the theater for the entire full week to have that. So it's a great possibility for us to work on that. And Michael called and said, yeah, are you interested? And I said, absolutely, no question about it. He said, you didn't ask about money. I said, I don't care about money. It'd be great if we could make some money doing this, but really, honestly, it needs to be here. He said, anybody else come to mind? I said, yeah, my friend Jamie Swiss would be great to be part of this. And then he talked to Jamie, and basically Jamie said, what's more important to you, making money or doing a good show? And Michael said, doing a good show. And Jamie said, that's the right answer. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to really make sure we're just doing the right thing here. And Michael said, anybody else? And he said, yeah, Todd Robbins. Mm-hmm. Michael also had a very good friend who I'd known, I'd worked with on cruise ships, but not with, but followed on cruise ships, Frank Brentz.
Frank, yeah, sure.
Frank great was guy. Just a wonderful performer, yeah. A great entertainer, mm-hmm. and I'm so sorry he's not with us anymore. Yeah. But he was instrumental to us in our early years, so there were really the five of us that got Monday Night Magic going. Mm-hmm. And originally we thought, well, let's do it once a month, the way they were doing it in London, and they're actually now only doing it a couple times a year. And we realized that you can't do it once a month. It has to be every week. You can't have an audience looking at this and going, well, let's see, are we the first week in the month, or what is this?
Yeah, then it goes, oh, well, heck, we'll do something else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it really needs to be weekly, so they don't even have to think about it. It's Monday, let's go see some magic.
Right.
And so we've been doing it. We're now in our 19th year. Mm-hmm. So we're...
You know. It had a lot of people from all over the world. I think a lot of people, I mean,
exactly.
Almost like the Magic Castle East from the standpoint of the number of people. I mean, I've been there even.
Exactly.
Even me.
Well, no, certainly not even you. But yeah, we've had 350 performers and entertainers
wow.
from all around the world come and do this. In some ways, it's a more discriminating venue even than the Magic Castle.
That's fewer magicians than I think have been on America's Got Talent.
Yeah, I think you're right. But it's a full show, you know. At this point, we've got an MC who sort of holds the whole show together and yeah. has a nice performing spot as part of it, but then we have an opening act that runs about 13 minutes roughly on that, somewhere between 10 and 15, and then we have a middle act or mm-hmm. second end of the first half who's meant to run about 20 to 25, about 22 minutes, something like that. Then there's a break and intermission, which we have close-up magic performing either in the front, right in front of the stage, and the lobby, and if we're really full, we'll have one in the middle of the theater as well, so we'll have three performers. So they see a lot of magic during that evening, and it's mm-hmm. a good 2 hours at least, 2 hours and 15 minutes of showtime.
And I know that Michael has worked out things with the tickets, so that way that they're available yes. just through tickets, the half-price place. I mean, you can buy tickets in advance and whatever left over, just like with the rest of the Broadway shows. I mean, of course, like where they first started over there where the Fantastics were. What was the theater called?
It was called the Sullivan Street Theater.
The Sullivan Street Theater, mm-hmm. which is beautiful.
Yes.
They worked for the best because the Fantastics were there, what, 40-plus years or something?
Yeah, can you imagine, you know, when they went in with that show to that theater, the landlord gave them a run-of-the-show lease.
Not thinking
it was going to run 40 years.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Somebody's kicking himself. So we started there, and actually we're really happy to be back down into the village again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been in six different theaters. We've been uptown. We've been down to the Soho Playhouse. We've been up at the St. Clement's Theater. We've been at Second Stage for different places. And we're really happy. We're now down at the Players Theater, which is on McDougal Street between Bleecker and West 3rd. And it's right in the heart of the village.
Did you lose some of the audience whenever that you move from one location
yeah,
to another?
That was one of the things that we considered. That was difficult. Again, just as we said, you know, you need to be there every Monday night.
Continuity.
The problem is that, exactly, if they are not sure where you are, it's a mm-hmm. little uncomfortable for them. Mm-hmm. And we really feel as though we've picked that back up again, being in the one mm-hmm. theater for the extended period of time. The other thing that we found that was kind of interesting was we were running a second show on Sundays called Magical mm-hmm. Nights at the Regency Theater, mm-hmm. It's a Regency Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually quite popular. It was connected up with Feinstein's. They had their main showroom, and we would work in the Regency room. Mm-hmm. We worked on and off with them there. And that was very popular. We had lots of folks come in and see us. Dick Cavett came in. I mean, we've had stars come in and see our show.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Jagger actually came in at one point. We have a photographer, a good buddy of ours, Mike Wartell, who is not a professional photographer, but is a professional photographer.
Mm-hmm.
He has other things that he does. But he was there that night when Jagger came in with his lady and son. And Mike looked over at them, and they saw him looking, and he smiled and turned back and didn't shoot a single picture. Deliberately not shooting Jagger, respecting his privacy,
mm-hmm.
and there was a bodyguard, basically somebody with Jagger at the same time, who came over afterwards and talked to Mike and said, "Excuse me, do you have a card?" And Mike said, "Yeah, sure, thank you very much." He wanted to say thank you for we appreciated your respecting Mr. Jagger's privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple weeks later, a little box arrived with this beautiful ring in it. With a little note that said, "Thanks again for respecting our privacy."
Wow. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, this will be the Magic Castle, of course, that they don't want you to take photos in there or ask for autographs, because there are a lot of celebrities, obviously, in Hollywood who are coming there who are members, and they don't want you to call on them or to use them. They're there for entertainment. I think it's the same way that you can imagine Mick Jagger and others. I mean, it's hard to walk down the street. You can't go to the grocery store.
Steve Martin has come by through there. I mean, Dick Cavett came to see our shows. And, I mean, you know, our friends have come in from all over the world. Jeremy Renner, Scarlett Johansson's come in. I mean, really, it's a wonderful opportunity to do that and to perform for people. And for me, it's an opportunity for me to work on material.
I was going to say, break in some new stuff.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how many people does it seat, the new theater?
220 people, which is actually a really nice size. Mm-hmm. It's a long, not a terribly wide theater, so it's kind of a shoebox. It's sort of in standard New York style on this. We're completely full at 220 people. We can barely fit that in, but 200 is a very comfortable number, and and these days we're seeing it quite full. So,
Well, that's one of those things, again, that just kind of takes a while, and you're going to be seeing later this evening over here at Esther's Follies. I don't know if you've had a chance to see Ray Anderson. Have you? Is he marvelous or what?
Fabulous.
See, he's my number one magician.
Oh, yes. I agree with you completely. I remember coming down and seeing him work on this, and I'm going, that's a Jared pedestal he's using on that thing. What is going? How's he doing this on this? It's like
it's
he's
like
doing
two
these
feet
major
away from the front
exactly.
row.
He's doing these incredible. He's doing great magic in this venue. And so I remember seeing
and a picture window
stuff.
Behind him.
Yes,
it's wide open to the streets.
Exactly.
People walking around like all 360 degrees. Yeah.
No, it's a
great
it's
personality.
It's a wonderful. You know, the other thing that we really are happy about with Monday Night Magic is we've really brought people from their early stage to great success as they've worked out material and they've come through our ranks. Ossie came and started, Ossie Wynn, you know, a good buddy came and started working for us just doing close-up magic. And he said, at a certain point, he said, I'd like to start doing some stage work. We said, you're not quite ready yet. Mm-hmm. So we gave him a little time, and then he did some other stuff. He tried some elsewhere. He was working on stuff, and eventually he came back. And because Jamie sits there and he goes, no, not ready. No. And so, you know, and there's, and eventually he started coming on, and then he became one of our great stars, you know, to come back there. Harrison Greenbaum now is doing great stuff for us. Does comedy magic, and you know, he came to us from our friends up in Boston, up in Mystery Lounge, where he'd been doing some stuff, and he again came to us, and he's gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. He was emceeing for us, and now he headlines for us. So it's really great to see that this has become an opportunity for people to come and learn and grow and develop themselves.
Well, that's one of those things, too. Certainly, you had Monday Night Magic, and then John Stetson and Steve Gerdolfer and the other guys put together Tuesday Night Magic up in Boston.
Well, they actually, I don't know, they may be a year behind us, but they are like at 17 or 18 years right now. Yeah, the Mystery Lounge that's up there, and whenever I get a chance, if I'm anywhere near there, I ask if they'll have me come up and work on their stage, and John says, yeah, please come on up. Because they're just absolutely.
Are they
great.
Still in the same?
Yep, up above
college.
Right above the Hong Kong restaurant up there. Mm-hmm. It's a comedy club that's up there normally nights, but on Tuesday nights it becomes the Mystery Lounge, and it's absolutely great. Yeah.
That is an unusual kind of venue, I think, for that to lasted this long. It's been I don't know how many years since I've last been there, but
it's absolutely great. You know, and it's Cradolfer and David Oliver.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely great, and that's another longtime friend of mine who I'm so glad is still with us here doing this stuff, and it's great to see him work. And, you know, another nice thing that's been good about that is that people come into town, and they may not stay in New York. Sometimes they'll come out and they'll stay with me in New Jersey, and I've had Leonard Green and all sorts of folks, you know, because Bob Sheets brought Leonard up, and we just hung out and had a great night. David used to come down and spend the night if he wasn't driving back on that evening, and he helped me actually write the locks routine that we're talking about. There's a whole little script section in there that we sat in one day, and we just hammered out this section as part of the work on this, you know. And this is the other great thing for me is that Ossie came and watched me working on that lock routine, and it was awful in the beginning. I mean, it was really, to me, it was an awful routine. It was just not where it needed to be. And I had like five different locks and different keys, and I was just, 'cause I wanted the visual image of all these different locks. And as you said, edit. Kill your darlings.
Yes.
Like
what John Carney said.
Exactly
about that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Kill
Faulkner,
your darlings.
Actually, whoever.
Exactly. And so Ossie turned to me and he said, one lock. I went, no, I've got to have these locks. I need the visual image of this. He said, one lock. I went, okay, all right, I'll do one launch.
So it's not so hard for the audience to focus on that one.
That becomes clear. Then it becomes about what it is, which is about the people.
Mm-hmm. It's not confusion.
Yeah. And again, you know, that's one of the other things that starts to come up on this sort of stuff. And again, I have people that give me ideas and thoughts and really help a lot. Karen, who gave me the original visual idea for this thing, I was having trouble because one of the problems that exists in something like Key Act is you have to have the keys tested. Hmm. You have to have the lock tested against the keys and make
to
sure
prove.
It, to prove it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually use a totally ungimmicked lock, so I'm not using a Key Act lock, just a completely normal lock. But I do want to make sure that they actually get a chance to test all the locks. But at a certain point, so what I was doing is I just hand out the keys to the front row and I have them pass along the lock until somebody finds the key that opens the lock, and then they continue passing it along and make sure everybody gets a chance to check.
Right.
And I realized at a certain point that wasn't even necessary. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to prove that, all that thing. So now it's down to I have a key, I have a glass full of keys. And I say, this is a little game, and I talk, sort of say, so your job is to find the one key that will open this lock. And I turn to the guy, and I say, give it a shot. He reaches in, he grabs a key at random. It doesn't work. That's all I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because later on, he's going to have it not work. I have the key that does work on a ribbon, and I turn to the lady, and I drop the key into the glass with a ribbon hanging over and say, you take a chance. You give a try. You see if you find one that works.
Yeah.
And she just picks up the ribbon, and of course, that's the key that opens it. Now I've proved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Hmm. Makes the point.
It does make the point.
Yeah, exactly.
So condensing, editing, getting out the extraneous stuff, even if you think they're not there. And the last point I'd make on this is that sometimes process needs to be not focused on, needs to become part of the story. So normally in the course of this with KRREC, you have to start eliminating keys.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I have all these keys. So this is, how do you go through choosing this? So instead of it just being, okay, choose half the keys, get rid of half of the keys.
Right. Takes more time.
Yeah, the point of this whole thing is in order for him to open your heart, he had to make a whole bunch of choices throughout his life. These are all these possible choices. Take these and divide those into two piles. So think back to that very first time. Did he walk up and introduce himself?
Mm-hmm.
Or were you introduced by friends or family?
Mm-hmm.
Did it just happen, or did he take the initiative?
Or was it set up? Yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, he took the initiative? Okay, let's get rid of all the other people keeps. You keep the self-starter keys. Take those, divide those into that first date. Think about that first important date. The first time he really takes you out, was it romantic, dinner and dancing? Or was it fun, like a movie or a hayride? Something fun like that. So which one was it, romantic or this? Okay, that's that. So now we're eliminating keys, but the eliminating keys is actually just part of telling the story.
Sure, and of course the people are feeling those emotions, and not just the people who are involved, but when you're saying that, other people are saying, I think back to whenever my husband had proposed to me or how we first met. So you're bringing in those other people, and it's just not a card trick or something, you know, that are inanimate
objects. And then he's down to two keys, and I say, hold one key in each hand and dig deep. And all of a sudden, Unchained Melody starts playing. And I go, oh, remember Slow Dances? He goes, yeah. I say, so do I. And I walk over to the lady, and I start dancing with her. And I say, take your time. Let me know when you've got a key. Oh, you've got one? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So then he goes to try his key, and of course, that key doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because then we go into that story. Yeah. But yeah, so this whole idea of making the process that you need to do interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing in some ways with the Lady Fair. The story is about these two people talking.
Right.
I need to show the handkerchiefs in the bag. I need to show the umbrella. It's the story that's kind of covers all of this showing demonstration stuff that then becomes part of the bigger story.
Magic should have a mystery, but it should also have something that is going to emote a feeling for people to be invested to care about it, you know, than necessarily.
Exactly.
Which goes back to what you were saying. You don't want to just sell soap. You want to have somebody's soul kind of invested in the thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Peter. This has been fantastic. I tell you what,
thanks.
The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So let me ask you,
what
is important to you? What's your philosophy of life? After all that you've been saying over here, what's your magic word? It could be a phrase, a sentence. What's important?
I it's almost trite for me to do this, but I've always said this. It says that I can't really do magic.
Mm-hmm.
I can just help you see it because magic happens in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
And that's where it is.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I've enjoyed this past hour.
Me
We're spending
too.
Some time
Thank
with it. Ladies and gentlemen, for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Peter Samuelson. This is Scotty out.
Thank you, Peter, for joining us on the Magic Word Podcast. Those were some pretty interesting words of advice, and I got a lot out of it. I'd like to go back and listen to that another time or two even to make sure that I've got it. I like what you had to say about selecting volunteers and everything else in there. Very well said. Anyhow, thanks again, and I appreciate all the listeners who are out there and for tuning in each week to hear the magic word to see what we've got new. Well, next week, I'm going to continue with a guest that was a part of the talent roster from the Texas Association of Magicians Annual Convention, Mr. Robert Baxt. He was an integral part of the convention, just as Peter was. And in Robert's case, that he gave a lecture on comedy magic. We happened to have a chance to sit down and chat. Take that back. Actually, we weren't sitting down. We were standing up after a show late one evening. In fact, it went early into the morning. And it was one of those conversations that just kind of went on for the point that we really didn't want to turn off the microphone because we were starting to capture some lightning in the bottle. So that's coming up next week. But for now, that's all there is for this week. If you have any questions, be sure to write me. That's Scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. If you have some suggestions or you'd like to join the Friends of the Magic Word, be sure to go to the website, hit the donate button up in the top left, or you can go to become a patron of the Magic Word, and you can then learn more about how that you can pledge your support. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and surprise someone you love, and enjoy a slow dance with them. This is Scotty out.